You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where if Daniel's wife visited the White House, she'd get people thrown in jail, not taken out. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisniewski, and if you would get people thrown in jail, no, that's a terrible, terrible introduction. If you enjoy your trip in the midside here today, please tell a friend. We always appreciate meeting new midsiders. We're really growing the community out there. People are participating in the Discord channel, and it is awesome because it keeps me off of the mean streets of social media. Joining me this trip from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
Don't entirely think you're wrong about my wife. I think her issue more so with the president would be foreign policy and, nuking the Middle East, or at least most of it. My wife thinks John Bolton is a sissy. That's how much of a hawk she is, so...
Also joining us from Dale's lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his gay white male privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. Yeah, I've really been enjoying our conversations on Discord. We've got a whole thread discussing the Fountainhead. We're sharing some news stories that aren't quite midside material, but are still interesting to talk about. Like last night, Elon went on a great rant against the media, so we talked about that.
How would one join this Discord?
Well, you can go to, you can click on the link on themidside.com or the Midside Facebook to go to Discord and open our server. And yeah, it's that easy. You can also download the app on your phone or on your computer or your iDevices, iPads. So it's super easy. So check out the link.
Daniel's asking everyone because he himself has not joined yet.
No. We'll slowly convince him.
The digital strategist in me hasn't quite figured it out, so.
We'll be sending out more links.
Elon was pointing out there was a lot of, he sort of had an old man get off my lawn sort of comment because people were criticizing him for wanting to start this media watchdog and rating system. And he was reminding everyone that he founded a company that was running bureaus, like news bureaus, before most of the people who are criticizing were even born.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think that's certainly not my criticism of the whole thing. My criticism of the whole thing is that who watches the Watchmen? That's my criticism of the whole thing.
Yeah, that's very true.
Like,
you do. Every individual, consider the source of the information, and then you decide if it's good information or not.
Yeah, it's mostly why I don't think these kind of things are necessary. When you get into things like Snopes and fact checkers, and then suddenly you have to have fact checkers for the fact checkers, and now we're going to have rating systems, then we're going to have rating systems for the rating systems. So just do your due diligence. We say that all the time on the show, due diligence.
Yeah, that's, I have a little different take. I don't mind having a couple of watchdogs keeping track of things. I kind of look at it like the Underwriters Lab sort of thing. Like, hey, we've got some objective standards that we can apply, and we'll be the experts at applying those. And you can take it or leave it. You can decide to get our seal or not get our seal.
But which government agency is going to subsidize this news venture of Elon Musk's?
Yeah, that's true. Hopefully none of them.
Mm. It'll never work. Optimism.
That's why what I've said before. Midside,
for Daniel's optimism.
And yeah, that's why we come. I thought it was for his rap skills.
That's right.
No, it's what I've said before, where social justice is sort of back ending and backing up into this accidental individualism, where eventually you'll have like the gay, half black, half Native American midget who's missing a leg, and that's the only way to represent that group is to have that one person. It's the same thing here, where eventually we're going to figure out the only way to really watch the Watchmen is if every individual does it him or herself.
From your mouth to Snyder's ears.
We'll get to that a little bit more a little bit later in the show. But first, I think we have a lot of absurd things to talk about in the news. Let's witness some farce in the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
The University of West Alabama has decided that being mean to each other should be against school conduct codes. Yes, as part of a new code of conduct, this university now prohibits harsh text messages, a policy that has earned it the worst possible rating from Campus Free Speech Watchdog Group. See how we set that up? We didn't really. Fire. The University of West Alabama's cyberbullying and cyber harassment policy defines harassment as, quote, conduct that disrupts the educational environment of the university, end quote. That conduct has been defined to include harsh text messages or emails, rumors sent by email or posted on social networking sites, and embarrassing pictures, videos, websites, or fake profiles. Policy provides several types of instances where social media can cause harm, mostly through this harsh text message and rumor nonsense. So, Justin, what do you think? When you were in college, how many violations would you have racked up by the second week of freshman year?
Oh, man, one of the things we loved doing undergrad was when my friends and I would call each other and nobody would answer, we would just leave the like most vitriolic, profane voicemails to each other. So if any of those had gotten out, we would have immediately been expelled from the school.
Yeah. It's not entirely clear what the punishments are, but I suspect it's one of these scenarios where you get drug in front of a school adjudication board that sort of arbitrarily gets to decide what your punishment is based on this completely subjective, harsh determination. So, William, any tips for would-be harassers?
Well, if only we could call the bully hunters to harass them back.
That's right.
I think that would solve everything. I think it's interesting. You know, one of the things when I was an undergrad at University of Michigan hundreds of years ago, I was pretty upset. We had this honor code for engineers and the code of student conduct, and it applied to us as long as we were students, whether we were on campus or not on campus. And the one that I had the most objection to is this is right when concealed carry was getting passed in Michigan, but it was the code of student conduct said possession of any weapons by students was a violation. And that would mean even off campus, right? So if you concealed carry off campus while a student, quote unquote, you could get in trouble. And I thought that was super backwards. And I think, I bet the same thing would apply here, right? Like if you're running, like, let's say you're like Pope Hat or, the fake, Kim Jong-un, North Korea, Twitter, person, you couldn't be a student here, right? Cause that would be fake, a fake profile. It would violate the agreement. And I bet these rules apply whether you're on campus or not on campus. So even if you take out the First Amendment issues of like, hey, this is a government school, you also have this weird, like, they're trying to apply standards to people that are members, which I guess would be okay, but this is a government thing, and yeah, it's applying whether it's a student function or not and things like that. This can't be legal.
Yeah, Mark Twain need not apply to Western Alabama University. So.
Yeah, think of all the authors that write under pseudonyms. That's true. You can't.
I think they'd be lucky if Mark Twain applied.
Well, they would, but go away, sir. We need none of your kind here. So
yeah, sidestepping the government thing. And what I'm saying we'll get into in sort of other related ways in the Life on the Midside segment here at the end of the episode. But William, what you're saying is something that really bothers me about society in general right now. And it's this idea that there's no separation between what you do at work and what you do at home. And this is a perfect example of it. Daniel asked me that question about the voicemails and about the way I interacted with my friends. And it seems like they would include that. So even what you're doing in your social personal life that's not related to school would then affect what happens in school. And we have the same thing with our jobs now, too, is where is the line between when someone says something inappropriate on social media and they deserve to lose their job? It seems like everyone's a public figure now, and that doesn't feel fair to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't feel fair at all. There's, you know, this is something that is not, it's not new in society, right? Where we are trying to find that line between what, like, how much of our private lives we can protect versus how much becomes public. And, you know, I don't remember exactly what the Ayn Rand quote is, but she talks about, like, civilization is about having privacy, right? Like, it's about having this ability to, you know, not have everything in your life be open and under scrutiny by everyone. And that doesn't mean that you shouldn't be judged for your actions, but it means having some allowance for things that you disagree with. Like, I'm not a religious person, but that doesn't mean I refuse to go to a doctor who is Catholic or eat at Chick-fil-A or, you know, something like that, right? Like, it's, what are you really judging selfishly? What are you really judging in other people for something like education, for involvement in the education at this school? What about that is important here? And what are the standards that you should judge other people in that school? And it should be focused around learning, not controlling behavior outside of school.
You eat it.
That's an excellent point, William.
Chick-fil-A.
And the more general point, Daniel, hold on, I'll let you go in 1 second. The more general point is, why do we care about things these celebrities do that are tertiary to what they're good at? Why do I care what an actor's religion is or what an actor's hobbies are and all of those kind of things? It's gotten to beyond learning about them to morally judging them. And I don't understand.
I was just going to note that William is a self-hating gay man for eating at Chick-fil-A. So, the Ayn Rand quote you're referring to comes from For the New Intellectual, specifically the essay The Soul of an Individualist, and the quote is, quote, civilization is the progress toward a society of privacy. The savage's whole existence is public, ruled by the laws of his tribe. Civilization is the process of setting man free from men. End quote. Love that lady. So,
yeah, she says it so much better than I do.
One of my...
And that's where we're at.
That is
everything
where we
is public, yeah. Now, and we all fight in our little tribes.
Indeed, except our tribe now is global. Nothing worse than a giant tribe, really. Because at least in the savages' day, you could just go to another tribe, right? Just go hang out somewhere else. Now, forget it. One of the things here is that I don't want to neglect the fact that we're not allowing students to build real life skills in terms of how they deal with other human beings. We're trying to protect them from all these instances of quote unquote harassment and bad behavior and microaggressions and actual aggressions and whatever, except that none of this allows a growing human being to figure out what it actually means to interact with other human beings, what it actually means to solve conflict, to ignore the noise, to decide for yourself what crosses the line. None of this allows a human being to actually grow into a free-thinking, conscious human being. It stifles all of those things, and just like if you were to keep a child breastfed through his 18th birthday and his stomach wouldn't develop the ability to eat actual food, the mind also needs to be taken off the teat of adulthood and government and whatever, and allowed to grow into a mind that can consume all sorts of intakes. Took that metaphor probably a little too far, but I think you get my point.
Boobs. That's all I heard.
That's right. Speaking of boobs, Miss America, you won't be seeing them anymore since it's scrapping its swimsuit competition, and judges will no longer judge these women based on their physical appearance, because what could possibly be worse? Gretchen Carlson, the first former Miss America to be named chair of the Board of Trustees of the Miss America organization, said, "We are no longer a pageant. We are a competition. In place of the swimsuit portion of the competition, Miss America contestants will now take part in a live interactive session with the judges." According to the organization, the contestants from all 50 states and the District of Columbia will be asked to demonstrate their passion, intelligence, and overall understanding of the job of Miss America. This is from Gretchen Carlson, I believe. She says, quote, "We heard from a lot of young women who say, we'd love to be part of your program, but we don't want to be out there in high heels in a swimsuit. So guess what? You don't have to do that anymore. Who doesn't want to be empowered, learn leadership skills, and pay for college, and be able to show the world who you are as a person from the inside of your soul?" Justin, other than being just a generally bad idea, what was your initial reaction to the news that they were canceling the Miss America swimsuit portion?
Well, my initial reaction was, this is the death knell for the Miss America pageant. Nobody's going to tune in anymore. There's no reason to watch this. What makes this any different from a fashion show at this point? And the way you've described it is it's even less of a fashion show. So that was my first reaction, was this is dead. It's going to get no more ratings. It's going to get no more sponsors. It's over. And my second reaction was, man, let's do Jeopardy, but not judge the winner based on who can answer trivia questions the best.
That's right.
Let's provide the opportunity to play football without having to put on pads and tackle other people.
That's right. Golden State, that's a basketball team, right? Didn't they just win the whatever championship, the basketball trophy, in like they shut out the other team? Well, that's unfair. Why don't we give the trophy to the team that didn't score as many baskets? Clearly.
Well, it's funny that you say that. Because the big backlash on social media has been, it's unfair that Kevin Durant, who has won the finals MVP the last two seasons, went to Golden State when they already had three All-Stars, and now they're winning every season. It was unfair, and he was a coward, because he should have gone to his own team and tried to beat them rather than joining him. So they're trying to discount his championships and his MVPs because of the unfair competitive advantage he created by moving to that team.
The unfair competitive advantage of being better than everyone else. That is an unfair competitive advantage. Indeed.
And they're even saying they're saying there's a meme going around where they're saying that his championship was given, whereas LeBron's anguish was earned, because LeBron worked hard to get to where he was, and all they did on Golden State was create a super team. So they didn't really earn their championship.
Yes. Well, before we continue down this horrible basketball tunnel that I started us down, William, now, as someone I don't think who was particularly watching Miss America for the swimsuit section, are you particularly hurt by this announcement?
No, I think this is a great opportunity for me, since I now identify as a woman, to enter the competition. So I'm very proud to announce that next year I will be applying, representing the Midside, which I know is not a state, but I think we can petition to get the Midside entered, recognized for Miss America next year. I think it's very important. You know, they say that the ratings really come down to the interview section. That's usually the highest part that's rated anyways in the show, which makes a lot of sense, because it's sort of like the American Idol sort of thing, where you want to see the really retarded answers that people give. So I think that's true. So I don't know if it's going to affect the ratings per se, but only time will tell. However, you know, I was more fascinated by the reactions by some of the former Miss Americas, because remember, the whole reason, like right now, this is all controlled by former Miss America winners after the whole Me Too sort of scandal they went through with some emails that were leaked or something. But you had one Miss America, former Miss America in particular, was talking about how she was a little disappointed that she found the swimsuit and sort of like fitness related things helped her with her fitness and diet and helped represent a positive body image and those sort of things. And I think that this could certainly turn into a you know, fat power sort of thing, right? Like where we're just going to ignore the fact that people are minds and bodies. Like the whole thing of making, of selecting like the best quote unquote woman to represent America has to look at both. It can't just look at one.
Well, that's an interesting thing you said there. And that's sort of been what I've been thinking about this crazy story. This to me, by the way, in terms of, you know, signposts for a culture, this is a particularly big one. Miss America has been a big part of American culture for a very long time. And to have this kind of drastic change is, to me, a very clear indicator of the way the culture is going. In particular, I'm glad you mentioned mind and body, because this, to me, Gretchen Carlson is creating one of the biggest mind-body fallacies that we've seen publicly in a while. She says at the end of that quote that I read earlier, "Who doesn't want to be empowered, learn leadership skills, and pay for college, and be able to show the world who you are as a person from the inside of your soul?" Where does Gretchen Carlson think the outside comes from? I mean, as someone who is a former competitor, was she just born fit? Was she born, you know, having this quote-unquote ideal body? Or did she have to think about and work on it over years and years and years and use her mind to figure that out, by the way? It's not as if she just instinctively knew what to eat or what kind of exercise to do, how to dress oneself, how to make oneself appear lovely. Those are all elements that are results of thinking, of the mind. It is a classic mind-body dichotomy to say that they're just being judged by what they are on the outside. Where does that come from? You're not born a 6-foot whatever model who looks like that. You have to create yourself in that image. Create yourself in that image, and that comes from the mind.
Daniel, I completely agree with you, and I have a question for Justin. Isn't this really just an attack on the good for being the good, particularly here, beauty? Isn't this just an attack on beauty? Like, why put the effort into being beautiful or recognizing beauty?
Yeah, it's exactly what you just said, William. That's 100% where they're going with this. This is so the women who could never be in the pageant can now be in the pageant. That is ultimately what this is going towards. I mean, we've talked about this with the body positivity movement. We've talked about this with how feminism has been hijacked in today's day and age. It's about making it so those women who are beautiful and who have earned their beauty and have earned, you know, their fitness will not be seen as the best anymore and breaking down that standard. And Daniel, it 100% goes to what you're saying, and it actually connects back to the last story. And it goes to maintaining an adolescent mentality that, no, you didn't earn these things. You were just born with it. Think about when everyone was in middle school and high school. Is the people who were the popular and the best looking weren't always the people who earned it. A lot of the times it was whoever just happened to genetically develop first or have good genes. But then as you go into adulthood, it's how you're able to maintain it and how you're able to take care of yourself and earn it from that point on. But because people are kept in this mentality of, oh, you didn't earn anything, you should feel guilty for your privilege, right? If we're going to talk about white privilege, and white privilege means, well, you don't have to deal with the harshness of reality that colored people do, minorities do. Well, it's the same thing with beauty privilege, right? We saw 30 Rock had an episode where Jon Hamm lived in the bubble, where things are just given to him and things work out for him just because he's naturally good looking. That's the mentality people live in this stunted, immature mind-body dichotomy, as you're saying, where they don't see the body as a result of the mind. And what they don't see as a kid, they think it's all purely genetic. They don't see the lifestyle these kids are raised in. They don't see how the parents are helping from the day that kid is born versus the way their parents don't help them.
Yeah. Well, I propose that we just move this thing along to its inevitable conclusion, which is a contest where you're basically not judged on anything and winners are chosen at random or some other way. I suggested on Twitter that we rename the Miss America pageant the John Rawls pageant, where contestants compete in nothing but a veil of ignorance. I think this is the ultimate egalitarian contest. Literally the judges will know nothing about the contestants. Not how they look, not what their gender is, not what their talents are, not where they were born, how they were born, what their age is, what their background is, what their psychology is. Nothing. They will just choose a winner totally randomly, and that person will get to be Zay America for the year of whatever it is.
I think that's completely wrong, that everyone in America, every woman in America should be Miss America at the same time.
That's even better.
Egalitarian enough.
That's right. We'll spend 2 hours of a contest where the judges know nothing about the contestants, and at the end, we'll name every woman in America Miss America for the year, every single year.
Just like all women were Time Magazine's Person of the Year. It should be the same exact thing.
I like it. This way we avoid all impropriety. This is totally egalitarian. Social justice for all. Everyone's a winner. What a beautiful culture we've created.
I have two questions. The first question is, aren't you describing Whose Line Is It Anyway, where the games and rules are made up and the points don't matter?
Except this is far less entertaining, but yes.
And the second thing is, logistically, they're still going to do the Miss World pageant, correct?
I guess.
So are all these other countries going to be making, like, you know, Miss Russia, Miss Latvia, Miss Philippines, and then we're going to send, like, Amy Schumer or Melissa McCarthy out there against these women? Is that what's going to happen now?
Although I would watch that movie where Melissa McCarthy gets somehow named Miss America and has to compete in the Miss World competition. I would watch that movie. You should pitch that to, like, Sony.
Well, isn't that called Miss Congeniality, starring Sandra Bullock?
Yeah, except that we need to take it, you know, to 11 for the social justice era, so. Maybe she can be deaf, too.
The reboot of Miss Congeniality, starring Melissa McCarthy?
Yeah, and she's also deaf. So. I think that would be...
Why is she deaf?
I don't know. It'd be funnier.
She has to be disabled, yeah.
Yeah, disabled in some way.
You learned anything from the new Battlefield edition, you have to be disabled in a whammon in order to be the main person.
That's right. So I think that's what we should do. And we should also stop giving the Lombardi trophy to the team that wins. The Lombardi trophy should go to the Browns every year. They need it more than the Eagles or the Patriots or any of the other winning teams. So,
huh. Hey, don't sleep on my Lions. They never win anything.
True. But somehow I still don't think they're worthy. Okay, so
well, they have the highest paid quarterback, don't they?
Well, there you go. That's
suckers.
That accounts for something. We got to give it to the team with the lowest paid quarterback. I don't know who that is, but anyway, moving right along here to a somewhat related story. I'm not sure.
Oh, this is related. This is 100% related.
This is an article that I hate that Justin sends along, these medium.com articles that are 68 printed pages long, that don't get to the point until about 41% of the way through. And it's usually by a social justice idiot who I can't stand reading. So thank you, Justin. This one is named The Deadly Incel Movement's Absurd Pop Culture Roots. And I'm literally not going to read almost any of this because it's very long. It is interesting from a historical perspective. This is by Sadie Doyle, who is apparently a feminist. Never heard of this person. But she goes through a little bit of a history of the men's rights movement online and how they were harassing her. And it was all, woe is me, etc. And she tries to figure out where this is all coming from. Of course, she mentions the red pill and the idea that men who take the red pill wake up and see that there's a malevolent feminist conspiracy aimed at suppressing the male gender, coming from the Matrix, etc. And then she goes into the pickup artist and that whole thing. And then there's this huge long section, which I didn't read, but I think there's a money quote down here, which is this. And then I'll sort of kick it over to Justin for the actual point of this article. Here it is. Quote, men own the narrative. Unless that changes, nothing will change. The Me Too movement has made it a bit trendier to give women an empathetic hearing, but gains like these are easily erased. Even still, women often have to come out in massive numbers to bring down even one predator. If a man has to be accused of more than 50 sexual assaults before we see him as a threat, we are still operating under Cassandra rules. So, Justin, there's a particular point to this article that you wanted to bring up. Please enlighten me.
Yes, this continues what I was talking about in the previous episode. And anyone out there who wanted to see what I was talking about and how it's becoming real, read this. The only reason to read this is to see what the enemy, and I'm saying this is the enemy because she is anti-reality, not because she is supposedly pro-women, but because she is anti-reality, what the enemy is thinking and how the enemy sees the world. Because all of this is doing exactly what I just said. Remember how I said they linked everyone on the right with the alt-right and everyone on the alt-right with Nazis? And I said they were going to do the same thing with pro-male things, right? They're going to say anything pro-male was like these incels who are trying to kill people and rape people. That's exactly what this article is. Not even a week after I said that, there's an article which goes all the way back to VH1's The Pickup Artist. Now, if anyone is familiar with The Pickup Artist, this is a reality show about a supposed great pickup artist named Mystery training a bunch of guys who were socially inept, and of course inept romantically, sexually with women, training them how to be pickup artists, and they picked the best ones, and he could join Mystery's like crew or whatever. Now, Mystery has a whole book called The Mystery Method. There's also the famous book called The Game by Neil Gaiman. Neil Gaiman has since written another book about him moving on from the pickup artist life. But all of these books and this pickup artist culture are answering a need in society. And the need in society is the lack of self-esteem for men and the lack of men learning how to properly interact and be men, right? This is, again, last week we talked about Jordan Peterson. It's the same thing. Jordan Peterson is identifying that and giving answers for that and providing that need as well. And this entire article is providing a false narrative while claiming that the narrative that exists is false. A false narrative about how all of these men who are doing this are evil. I was reading this whole thing and everything about it is just a lie. It's just all fake. You talk about the pickup artist stuff. It talks about how the pickup artist stuff condones rape. That's what it says. I read The Mystery Method. I watched The Pickup Artist. I read The Game by Neil Gaiman. I read his second book. And while I don't like those methods because they're decontextualized, they're not individualized. It just teaches it like men and women are a computer, a program. And if you act a certain way, then you can get the results you want. Where I think it's obviously believing in individualism, that people are individuals. I think a lot of these skills can be helpful, but they have to be applied on an individual level, and you have to get to know people and respond in the context. But they act like it's rape. She uses the example of when a guy is giving a massage, he's taught to tell the girl, oh, well, if you take off your pants, it'll make it easier for me to give the massage. And again, this is like the Aziz thing. Is there no responsibility on the woman? If a guy is giving you a massage and says to take off your pants, don't you stop and go, no? But supposedly it becomes rape because the guy keeps escalating and the girl never says no, and she's calling that rape. Same thing, Roosh, R-O-O-S-H, is a guy who wrote a Jonathan Swift-style article about, you know, what if rape was legalized? And he wrote at the top of it, this is satire. I obviously am against rape and have written that many times. But in the article it claimed he is pro-rape. Similarly, we've discussed the Red Pill documentary here on this show. It was actually made by a woman who had this perspective that these MRA people were anti-women and hateful. And she went in and discovered it wasn't that way. So is she part of this evil, toxic male narrative? So the whole point is, this is a, to me, it almost reads like the screed of someone who is psychologically damaged. But this is how the narrative is being controlled right now. And to me, that is terrifying. Because it's going to get to the point that if we continue to accept this and allow this to go unchallenged and we let it be a general idea, then it's going to be impossible to be a guy at all.
Well, if there's anything about this that makes me not worry about it too much, although I see your point totally, it's that this is the left's only tactic. It's just now applied to masculinity. Now, granted, the tactic has worked in the past, but I have to think that there is a generation of human beings now who are waking up, taking a red pill, if you will, for the whole left, and seeing that this tactic is used over and over again. And the tactic is a very simple one, which is, what is the worst straw man thing in reality that we can tie to some movement that we don't like, i.e. all, you know, laissez-faire people, want old people to die in the streets, or all conservatives are alt-right, all alt-right are Nazis, for instance. But it's not working that well anymore. And you saw that with Trump's victory, I think. I mean, how many times was Trump called a Hitler-esque or maybe Mussolini-esque rapist, etc., misogynist, certainly, and it just didn't work. People didn't care. And it's not because there are more people okay with racist, misogynistic behavior. It's because the left has overplayed their hand so many times, and this is another example of that. So maybe I'll get William to weigh in here. Do you think this is going to be effective, or is is the left's time up, to use a phrase?
Yeah, Daniel, I agree with you. This is becoming increasingly transparent to everyone who's paying attention. There's another tactic in here that we see all the time. It comes back to judging groups, judging individuals based on group attributes, right? So clearly, some of these people are anti-feminist. They're all sort of aligned with that concept, right? They're against what modern feminists, this modern nihilistic Marxist feminists represent. So therefore, we can apply all attributes from the worst of these people to all of these people, right?
Yeah.
Because we don't judge people individually. So in their mind, there's no difference from that that murderous, vile human being who killed people and Jordan Peterson, because they're both against modern feminism. There's no difference between them. They're both the same. And that kind of logic is just completely transparent in this article. Like they're spelling it out for you. They're saying, hey, incels are bad and evil and they're anti-women. Those are all true. Well, you know else is anti-women? Jordan Peterson and Milo and people who fight for men's rights and divorce. They're all anti-women. Therefore, they're all incels. It's a very collectivistic argument. And I hope that is what is becoming transparent here to people, is to see that this collectivism is the problem, right?
Yeah.
It's the ideas too, but that lower level razor that you can cut all of this cancer away is understanding collectivism and seeing that right up front.
It also fails basic logic, but yeah. Justin, I'm often want to say that Hitler was a vegetarian painter, and therefore all painters and vegetarians are evil. Same kind of logic, right?
Yeah, it's 100% the same logic. And William, I had actually forgotten that the article devolves all the way into lumping Milo into this. And when I got there, I was like, really? You're just going against everything that you hate. And what you guys are saying about the collective judging is well taken, because one of the things I think about when I hear about this incel movement and everything, quote unquote movement, I don't even want to call it that. It's a bunch of people who are on the internet complaining, and then a couple psychopaths who latched onto it. But what I hear about that is, and when I hear about it, I think about myself and how if this had happened, what, less than 10 years ago, 10 years ago, when I was in grad school and college, would I have been linked to this? Because I, you know, didn't lose my virginity till I was almost 28. So what would people have said about me who was anti-left and that was the way I was, and I had a hard time dating and struggled with dating and making social connections, especially with women. Would people have linked me in that? Because that's the way we're thinking now. And it scares me to think of that, because part of the reason this hits me hard when I read this stuff and it scares me is I watched The Pickup Artist. I read The Mystery Method. I read The Game, and I did take some values from those things, because I was never taught explicit, concrete techniques as far as dating and approaching women. I was never taught those things. I was never had those discussions. That's not in our culture. All I was ever told was the very feminine, it just happens. Just go with the flow. So I did. I'm one of these people who I took value from these things, but I obviously am not one of these extremists, and I obviously saw the problems with it as well. I outlined that at the top of the pickup artist. I always saw those problems where it was very, as William's saying, I saw it as very collective from the beginning. But I did see the individual ways in which I can improve myself. So it scares me to think that 10 years, I missed by 10 years being basically the evil that society hates. I don't know how much harder it would have been for myself, for me, if I had grown up in this age.
Yeah. Agreed. It's depressing to think about. Any closing thoughts?
Well, it's depressing.
On this? Because otherwise we're going to go on to even more depressing. Yeah.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I think it leads into the next article, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, speaking of depressing, suicide rates are up 30% since 1999, the CDC says. And only about half of people who died by suicide had diagnosed mental health conditions. So, this was an article on NBC News, but it's mostly a CDC report, Center for Disease Control report, and obviously it's coming off of the news that fashion designer Kate Spade and celebrity chef Anthony Bourdain both killed themselves recently. Kate Spade was 51, Kate Spade was 55, Anthony Bourdain was 61. So it's basically suicide rates among all ethnicities, all genders, all age groups are up. In every state it's up, except Nevada, interestingly, but Nevada already had a very high suicide rate. Anyway, middle-aged adults had the largest number of suicides and a particularly high increase in suicide rates. So the only group, in fact, exempt from the rise in suicide rates was people over 75. Who figure, I've made it this far, I'll just let this thing ride.
They're like, I don't need to kill myself. I'm going to just keel over here in a year or two anyway.
That's right. Nearly 45,000 people died by suicide in 2016, the latest year for which numbers are available. Justin, there are some interesting things to delve into in this story, but how do you see this story and the few stories before this as related?
It has to do with what you guys are saying about this collectivizing of everything. It's the collectivizing combined with the not being able to earn anything and being told you're a bad person for being better than other people. So the first thing is, if you're collectivizing everything, just think of these incels, right? Let's use the incels as an example. And I hate that it's going to come across that I'm defending incels, but I don't mean the movement. I mean men who are struggling socially, right? Men who are having a hard time making connections. What they're missing is they're missing psychological visibility. They're missing people seeing them as individuals and valuing them as individuals. And then on top of that, you don't let them have self-esteem either, because, you know, the Fountainhead is something we're going to be talking about going forward over the next couple years. We're going to talk about it later in the episode. Take Howard Roark, for example. He was by himself a lot of the time, so he was missing the psychological visibility, right? That's the number one thing he's missing. That's his biggest internal conflict in the book, is nobody will see him for what he is because of the way Tui is telling everyone to be collectivized and be anti the good. But then what he has is his unshakable self-esteem, where he says, I enjoy doing this and I'm doing this because I love it and I love myself. We're taking that away too. So if you have people just be part of a giant group where nobody can see them, and then you tell them that they're not good, what choice do they have?
Yeah, that's interesting perspective on this. Did anything stand out to you, William, in this article, either that was there or perhaps that wasn't there? I'm going to hint at something.
I'm glad you asked me that.
Yeah.
There was something that wasn't there that was actually in the report. 84% of these suicides are male. Why isn't that in the report? This is primarily a problem among males. This is not discounting that there are females who commit suicide, but the reason we see this giant increase is majority male. And until we address the issues around having helping boys develop good skills and being able to cope with society. And until we have more societal infrastructure, and I don't mean government infrastructure, but like societal infrastructure to support boys and young men, we're always going to have this problem. I know you guys can probably identify with this too, but you know, your early 20s are rough. They're super rough for a guy. You can't attract any women if you're straight. Your job is very hit or miss. You know, you're in school, you're working all the time. There's this society that's not supportive of anything that you value. It's a rough time, and we just don't have any support for guys. And it's really mind-boggling. Even in the article, in the CDC article, they're showing pictures of women. And it's a male problem.
Yeah.
It's just mind-boggling.
It's certainly a gender gap that doesn't get talked about as much as some of the other gender gaps. So as you said...
I think it's worse. I think it's worse than people realize. Because, and we know this from other studies, and I'm not sure, I couldn't spend as much show prep time on this as I wanted to, but I know from my recent reading of The Boy Crisis, which I think I've plugged on the show before, that they find that a lot of accidental male deaths are actually suicides because guys want to leave the insurance for their family. And it's a hard number to study, but they know it's significant. So this number could be even higher than the 84% that we're seeing.
Yeah, that's interesting. It didn't immediately occur to me, William, but it's actually very interesting that this, as you point out, the CDC website with this actual study, the opening image, which is a video, is of two black women talking about suicide. The next one is an ethnic woman. I can't tell, but she is ethnic of some sort. Then there's some little pictures down here. There's 1, 2, 3, 4 women and 3 men in these little pictures down here. But over 80% of suicides are men. In fact, I looked it up on another site. Ready for this mind-blowing stat? 70%, 7 in 10 of the suicides in 2016 were white men. Another example of white male privilege at work.
We cannot make a difference here if you really want to. If you really want to make a difference, you have to recognize reality. And this doesn't fit anyone's narrative, and so the news media is not going to recognize the facts of reality here, and it's really sad.
So I guess this is where
only compounds the problem.
It does compound the problem totally, because it makes, I don't know. It's oddly marginalizing, to use that word, I think. But
and I'm going to go on a Justin style rant here. All you SJWs out there who talk about toxic white maleness, look at what it's doing. This is a direct stat. The more we talk about how privileged white males are, you're going to see more and more deaths. And it's you guys. It's this idea that is doing it.
Yeah. Well, if any midsiders feeling down.
Wait. You said that's a Justin-style rant. That was like 10 seconds.
Well, I figured you would go into the psychologicalizing for me.
It's a Justin-style rant.
I think you're doing a wonderful job, both of you, of expounding upon what I was saying. A sort of a suppressed premise of what I was saying was that it was the men. But I wasn't saying that directly, because it does... I think it applies to the more rational women as well. I mean, think about if you're a more rational woman and you're looking for like a rational man, and you're looking for that psychological visibility, and you're looking to be, you know, treated fairly for the way you've created yourself and earned, it's going to treat you the same way. I just think that we've, for a very long time, cultivated a society where we encourage women to be emotionalists, that they are not in a position for this to hurt them as much. I mean, that's one of the biggest things that male disposability that the MRAs talk about, is that basically this patriarchy that everyone complains about actually was squarely on the shoulders of the men, where they were the ones who had to bear the burden of reality and making the world and the whims of the women and children fit. And now that they're being told, oh, wow, you know, you're wrong and evil for doing that. It's like, well, what can I do? There's no way I can win. Where now that doesn't affect the women as much because they're learning to face reality for the first time. That's a lot of the argument of the male disposability and what that means.
Yeah. And Justin, I think this also ties back to what we were talking about earlier, the point I made earlier about the group and the individual. It's the root of the problem here again is not identifying reality that there is maleness and there are male behaviors and male psychology that needs to be identified and properly channeled to be flourishing in order to have a flourishing life, and that it's an individual thing. When people judge all men, all white men, and start talking about how they're privileged and toxic, people who buy into that collectivism, if they take the idea seriously, this is the road it leads to.
Yeah.
It's the road it leads to, and it ignores the basic problem, which is that they're not treating people individually as they're growing up and giving them the individual attention they need. Yeah. I mean, just talking about my own experience a little bit more. Look, my dad came from poverty. My mom came from poverty. They came from poor families. My dad worked really hard, and he provided me and my brothers, and with the help of my mom, who is a nurse and is very good at that and works very hard, provided a great lifestyle for us. But what they did not provide was, especially my dad, did not provide individual male advice and male attention to each of us, so that we could each grow in the way we needed with our weaknesses and our strengths. It was just, this is how you raise kids and this is how you provide for a family. So even the idea of looking at the family unit as a collective is harmful to young boys. And I'm sure it's harmful to young girls as well, but we're really seeing the way it's hurt young boys, especially when, you know, my dad comes from an Eastern European culture where Eastern European fathers are known for being sort of emotionally removed from the family.
Mm-hmm. Well, if any mid-centers out there are feeling depressed or having suicidal thoughts, certainly you can reach out to any of us. We're happy to chat. We're not experts. You should probably get help. But that's a step too far.
But Daniel, what? I'm glad you went in that direction because I thought you were going to do what everyone's doing on social media. Call the hotline. No. Reach out to someone who will hear you out, rather than just calling a generic hotline. And stop telling people to call a hotline. Maybe if you said, like Daniel just said, it shows Daniel's benevolence. If you said, hey, talk to me, maybe you could actually help someone rather than pawning it off on someone else and pawning it off on the group. Oh, this is the group's problem. Call the society's solution. No, be part of the solution. If you're not, you're part of the problem.
Yeah. Agreed. I'm a strong...
In your own life, if you see people who are exhibiting behaviors like withdrawing, if they're not sleeping or sleeping too much, or they're posting weird shit on social media, reach out to them. Like you don't know, you know, if you know someone and you can provide that visibility, that can start their cycle of healing. So this is on all of us.
Yeah. And one minor thing I'll say about what Justin said is, yeah, you can absolutely reach out to me, or I'm sure Justin or William. Always happy to talk. I'm a strong believer in therapy and getting legit professional help, but sometimes why I say reach out to someone like us or a friend first is that sometimes that can be a bridge too far. That can be something that causes too much anxiety. So talking with someone you care about or just someone you know, just someone who's familiar. I may not know Midsiders, but they listen to my voice all the time, so...
Yeah, and yeah. We share the same values, and that's a connection that we can have. That's a visibility that we can have with other people.
Right, and when people reach out to me and I help them, if there is a point where it's beyond my knowledge and expertise, I do say to them, look, I've told you all I can, and this would be the time to consult an expert now, and I would urge you to go to therapy. I've done it. It helped me, and I think this is a point that an expert would help you a lot more than I would, and I fully support you, and I'm here for you, but that's the limitations of what I can do as a friend, and you know I'm here for you, but that's what experts are for. So I think it's important that if someone does reach out to you, to know your own limitations as well.
Totally.
All right, so as we talk about that and we talk about knowing our own limitations, I think a place where people are missing that nowadays is in art discussion and art analysis. Thankfully, I know my limitations are non-existent, and that's why I host the next segment. It's time for The Hopeful Romantic with JML. I want to talk about really quickly here. I don't want to like go into this forever, but I want to talk about a couple of older movies, one really old movie and one that was a few years old. I don't know the exact year. Daniel can tell us that, but it has a sequel coming out. And I want to talk about both of these because the content is relevant to the fact that Zack Snyder is going to be doing an adaptation of The Fountainhead. The first one is the original Fountainhead adaptation. I finally watched this movie. Now, the first thing is I want to be clear. I really don't like the old style of acting and directing. Acting especially is very wooden to me, the old style. So I had to look past that. But looking past that, I would say the biggest problem with the Fountainhead movie is the first, I don't know, third of the movie where there's no conflict. It really is, Daniel. We've said this about the Atlas Shrugged trilogy, and I think we said this about another movie recently too. It really is just a series of vignettes up until the point that Dominique and Wynand are introduced, and then it becomes a story with a conflict. But up until that point, because Peter Keating's character is taken out of the story, basically, he becomes a little more than a plot device. There's no conflict, and it becomes a series of vignettes. Well, what have you guys, have you seen the Fountainhead movie? What have you guys thought about it?
It's been a while for me, but there was a similar sort of, I don't think I identified it as not having tension, or not having, what did you say, Justin? Sorry, what was the word you used? Conflict.
There's no conflict.
Not having conflict. I identified it, to me as simply, whatever, you know, Rourke is thinking in the books and whatever, you know, other characters are thinking, it's not being translated to this movie. And so it's less interesting because of that. A lot of what's so amazing about The Fountainhead is the psychology of the characters. And that's going to be, that has to be particularly difficult to portray in a visual medium.
Yeah, it's been a lot.
It's been a
long time since I've seen it. And I never did identify what you had said, that it was a missing conflict. I think that's really fascinating. I think I agree with you. Like the beginning of the movie is slow. But overall, I think it tries to meet that theme. And I think you guys probably know better than I do, but wasn't there some something about like after the actors saw the movie, they thought, oh, we've done it wrong. We should have done it a different way. I can't, for some reason, that's bubbling up in my head. Maybe I'll look it up and see if I can find out what that quote is.
Hmm. Yeah. I'm not sure I heard that. I know that, there were lots of not rumors, but lots of discussion about how Gary Cooper didn't quite get the role. He didn't quite understand what he was going for. I thought Patricia Neal was the best part of the movie, but.
Yeah, I thought the Rourke-Dominique romance was the best part of the movie. But again, that's because the conflict was introduced. And everything you guys are saying is very well taken with the psychologies and it being difficult to portray that visually. And that's why I'm excited for Snyder to do this, because I think if there's one person who can actually get that, I think it's him. I think he's very good at showing these characters acting rather than just telling. There was a lot of telling in the Fountainhead movie. And I'm gonna say something controversial here. I hope Snyder does not stick to the original
That's
Ayn
it.
Rand script.
Get out
and
of
I
objectivism.
Say that because it's all right. I've been kicked out many times. So it's already about, what, 2 hours, an hour and 45? I think if he at least adds another hour, he can add a lot of Keating stuff back in. But I also want to see the backgrounds of Wynand, the backgrounds, the flashbacks of Tui. And I want to see stuff like Rourke standing on the cliff naked laughing. I want to see Dominique, rather than saying, oh, I pushed that, right? This is one of the worst cases of telling rather than showing in the Fountainhead movie. Dominique says, oh yeah, that beautiful statue I had, I pushed it down the stairs. Wouldn't it be much more compelling to show her doing that?
Yeah, totally.
You know, I wonder, is it set that it's going to be a movie, or could it be a miniseries?
Well, someone in our Discord channel linked to Fiona, the Chinese Snyder fan who made the ForTheSnyderCut.com website and supposedly is in contact with Snyder on Vero, and she claimed on Vero that Snyder told her that it's going to be a miniseries, but the only word we have is hers. Her saying, oh, Snyder told me it's going to be a miniseries.
Yeah, well, certainly if it's a...
Could it be?
Well, certainly if it's a miniseries, like, they should throw out the existing script, or at least not completely throw it out, but you know what I mean? Like, they need to start fresh, but use that as good source material, because, you know, Rand may not have been a filmmaking expert, but the fidelity to the characters is key to communicate the theme. Like, everything is so integrated in Rand's work. If you, you know, if you drop, like you were saying, like pulling out Peter really takes away from communicating the theme.
Yeah,
I agree. I think, and again, this is going to be blasphemy here, I think Rand was a much better novelist than she was a screenwriter, and I think it shows in the script she wrote.
We know that's
for
true for lots of things, right? Like, people, directors that are novelists, they fall often in that trap of telling and not showing, right? It's usually the folks that come up on that other side of screenwriting, or the more visual side, that come up with the more compelling movies.
Here's a bit of trivia that I did not know about the film. Compelled by the message of Rand's novel, Cooper and Neal, the stars of the film, let it be known publicly that they were having an affair, and that the public knowledge of their relationship actually negatively impacted the film's box office numbers. Interesting.
She's talking about making objectivism look bad.
Although the Fountainhead has an 83% Rotten Tomato score, so critics didn't totally pan it, didn't totally hate it at the time. I mean, you have to compare it with the movies of the time, right? So it's very similar style to the movies of the time.
Yeah, am I the only one who has a problem with that style and finds it very hard to get into?
It's really actor dependent for me, and Gary Cooper is not. This is also blasphemy, not one of my favorites. So his movies are always a little bit difficult, but yeah, I don't necessarily hate that style.
Is it, you find it too wooden? Is that what you're saying, Justin? I wonder.
The acting is very wooden.
I wonder if it's a contrast between like stage acting and film acting, right? Like an overcorrection. Because you can definitely tell from movies in the time, folks who are stage actors, they almost are overboard in the wrong direction. Right, they're everything's too big and too, I don't know, almost like caricature.
Yeah,
I mean, I think that is exactly the problem we're still dealing with, especially in television, where I've said this before, and I said this in the FAQ I wrote, is a movie is not simply a play that you film, but I think still today in motion pictures, that's what we're dealing with, is people are just filming plays. It's not form follows function, right? It's form. They have the form coming from the function. And because that, they see, oh, well, this is how we did it before. This is how we're going to continue to do that. I don't think there's been enough redefinition of movie making. I think we're seeing that now. We're starting to see a lot of that now, but I still think that's a major problem. And yeah, I think that's a lot of where that comes from. A lot of this plays like, a lot of the Fountainhead plays like, they're just filming a play. And, you know, I have sympathy because part of that is budgetary constraints. But acting, they certainly could have thought about how to do that differently, because it's much different acting when you have so many takes and you can do it over and over again versus doing it live once on stage.
Yeah. Anyway, if anyone, Midsiders, disagree with us out there, let us know on Facebook, Twitter, etc., at The Midside, what you thought of the Fountainhead movie.
Yeah, or join our Fountainhead.
Yeah, you can tell us in the Discord channel as well.
Discord channel.
Oh, yeah, that.
That thing that you haven't seen yet.
And speaking of which, I am going to be doing a reread of The Fountainhead, specifically to focus on the idea of what elements could be visual, how Snyder could handle them. So, you know, in the coming weeks, I don't know when I'm going to start exactly, but if you want to participate in that reread, I will be telling people when I'm going to be reading each chapter, when I aim to have it done by, and you want to participate in that. Maybe we can do a bi-weekly or twice a week thing or once a week thing. Just join the Discord channel and we can get that going too. Now, another movie that I watched this past weekend that is objectivist adjacent, you know, director Brad Bird has been called an objectivist before, said he has objectivist sympathies, is The Incredibles. And The Incredibles is a Pixar film that the first time I saw it, I didn't really like it. So I really wanted to go back and watch it again because it gets so much hype, not just within my friend group, but within the society in general, so much so that Incredibles 2 comes out this week. You'll be hearing this episode the week it comes out. So I wanted to watch it again. And Daniel, I say this specifically to you because you love animated films and everything, and we'll see that in Trailer Takedown. I watched this again, and I understand why you like it now. I mean, specifically the line that stuck out to me was when Elastigirl wants Mr. Incredible to go to Dash's fifth grade or fourth grade graduation or whatever it is. Fifth grade, I think it is. And Mr. Incredible's like, why are we giving him a trophy for doing what's normal? We're continuing to say being excellent is bad, and then we're rewarding mediocrity. Yeah. And that's what the whole movie is about. It's about somebody who wasn't super trying to make himself super by destroying the supers and faking his own powers through technology. So I get thematically why it's appealing. But my major problem with this movie is I find it boring in large parts. When they're just on the island, everything about it is so boring. I feel like I'm moving mechanically through it, and there's a lot of wasted time in a very slow pace. I just think the movie was paced a lot slower than it could have been.
Are your pleasure centers burned out? Like, do you need to take, like, 2 months off of watching anything? Because I think this is a nonstop thrill ride from beginning to end. I just rewatched it again with my wife. We watched it last month. It is one of the few movies, Pixar actually makes some of them, but most of them, I'd say. It's one of the few movies where I don't feel like I need to be on my phone or my computer or doing something. I can just sit down and watch that movie, and I am engrossed from the opening scene to the closing credits. So, I don't know what's up with you, Justin. I find it to be a nonstop thrill ride. I absolutely unequivocally love this movie.
Yeah, I don't see any problems with the pacing. I haven't seen it in the last 6 months, I would say. But yeah, I didn't find any slow parts in it. I wonder if there's something particular that you, like you said, on the island, like what particular scenes did you find that weren't moving along?
To me, it's just sort of like, okay, we're talking about where he gets pushed underwater and everything. Like, I know what's going to happen and I know where it's going. And I'm just like, okay, can we just get to the point where he's pushed underwater and we can cut back to his wife going back to save him now? And we know that she's going to meet up with Edna and blah, blah, blah. It's just, I know like what all the beats are before they happen. And I want to get through to them more quickly because I know what's going to happen. I'm just like, whatever, just keep going with it. Get it
over
with.
In a 3-course meal, I know the dessert's coming, but that doesn't mean I don't want to savor the steak in front of me. Like, just because you know where something is going doesn't mean it has to be slow or poorly paced. I disagree with that totally. But
right. Well, I mean, I'm not saying that. I'm just explaining my experience.
Your experience is wrong.
Stop being wrong.
Have better emotions.
It could be. I'm just telling you what my experience is.
Have better emotions. I mean, there are so many good lines in this. That one is obviously one. The one that gets pointed out a billion times a day by objectivists is when I think it's Elastigirl says something like, you know, everyone's special, and Violet says that's just another way of saying no one is, or Dash says that that's just a way of saying no one is. That one that gets pointed out. Also the tricycle kid, when Bob asks him what are you waiting for, and he goes, I don't know, for something great to happen, I guess. And Bob says, yeah, me too.
Yeah, I liked that one because it was very much showing the character's psychology. It wasn't just philosophically pedantic.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is centered around what it means. I mean, the whole plot, right, where superheroes have to go underground because we're too litigious. Like, we can't appreciate they're helping us. We have to take advantage of them in different ways. I think all of that is very related to the themes you find in Ayn Rand's novels. I don't want to go as far as to say as Brad Bird's an objectivist. He's sort of blatantly disavowed that title, so I won't give it to him. But I would say that the idea that, you know, being exceptional is not a bad thing, that there are people who are, you know, who are quote-unquote greater than other people. My greatest fear, in fact, for the upcoming sequel is that they do something to subvert that theme, that Brad Bird is going to be apologetic about The Incredibles and how that theme came out. So
yeah, this just in, Rian Johnson has been hired to, oh, to finish the movie. Subversion.
Wait. Is that, yeah, is that a joke or is that serious?
It was a Star Wars related joke. That's why Daniel thought it was funny.
Yes.
Well, no, I mean, it's funny, but that shows how scared I am of Disney right now.
Yeah, I hope they don't take it in a weird egalitarian direction. I hope they're faithful to the theme of the first. But and also,
I hope
Edna,
we get more Edna.
My hope,
I mean, Edna Mode's character is basically Ayn Rand, right? Like, look at her.
Yes.
Play it.
So you're saying Edna Mode and Gorski from Sucker Punch
basically
are the same,
yeah,
character.
Totally. And Edna's played by Brad Bird, by the way. I think that's funny. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
no, my hope for the second is they show more of the family life. And I think that's why I sort of was kind of a little bit bored, or I just wasn't that interested, because it was a lot of them fighting syndrome. And I liked the stuff about the kids, like learning to use their powers and stuff. But I think I wanted to see more of the family interacting and learning to appreciate and properly, you know, raise each other up.
I like that element. I want to see more mid-century modern architecture. That's what I want to see. And by the advertisement that they ran through Zillow, where they showed off the Incredibles' new home, I think I'm going to be well satisfied on that regard.
Were you just trying to link this back to the
Maybe,
Fountainhead?
There are lots of themes that you find in Ayn Rand's novels. Just saying.
All right, well, you want to know what my favorite Pixar movie is, Daniel?
What?
Monsters University.
Really?
I was very impressed when I saw that movie. To me, that's a whole movie about the mind-body dichotomy.
I could name three off the top of my head that are better than that, but it was a good movie. I appreciated it. Monsters,
I
Inc.,
it
in
much,
fact,
so
would be one of the
maybe it's just a
it's better than that, but
I liked Monsters, Inc. less than Monsters University. I don't know. There's something wrong
Pleasure
with
Pleasure Centers, man. They're burned out like little fuses. You got to go.
All right. Let's talk about a bunch of animated movies that are going to come out. And whenever we do Trailer Takedown, Midsiders, you can always go to the midside.com and see the Trailer Takedown preview. So you can pause the episode now, watch the trailers, unpause it, and then know what we're talking about rather than just being like, what are these guys talking about?
Good impression of the audience.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World, is the third movie in the How to Train Your Dragon series. And they go to a world that's full of hidden dragons, and then there are other people who want to kill the hidden world. I mean, I think that's what I'm taking away. But it confuses me a little bit, because I thought at the first one they found the hidden dragon island. So I don't really know what's going on in this trailer, and I'm kind of fatigued I don't really see the need to keep this franchise going. So for me personally, this is a tackle.
Tackle.
Daniel?
You can't tackle it. You can't do it. You can't tackle How to Train Your Dragon. It's the final in a trilogy. I don't know if they always plan the trilogy, but they've said this is the last How to Train Your Dragon movie. That doesn't mean there won't be other How to Train Your Dragon stuff, because there's a Netflix show that's going gangbusters, and they're still making a gajillion dollars off of this franchise. Kids love this franchise. It's super popular. I love this franchise. I thought the How to Train Your Dragon, the very first movie, ranks among the best animated movies of all time. It's up there with any good Pixar movie, and I think it lost the Academy Award that year to a Pixar movie that didn't deserve to win it, actually. I need to look that up. But from what I sort of got from the trailer is the other Toothless that they find, the female Toothless, can like go into like a different dimension. And so the dimension she's in is the dimension they enter and find all the crazy dragons. So I think that's what's going on. But to Justin's point, it is a little jumbled what the actual plot is going to be, other than male-female dragon relations and also more fighting with the dragons. So I'm hugging unapologetically. I'll probably see it twice. I think this is a great series.
I will say that saying there's an alternate dimension... I'm very close to a hug now.
It's so close to time travel.
William.
White Knight, the movie. Tackle.
Tackle.
How dare you?
See, okay, I'm glad you said something like that. I also really didn't like the ending to the original How to Train Your Dragon. Because it was all about, like, wasn't there a... Daniel, remind me of the movie. Wasn't there someone, like, threatening their society?
Well... kind of. They were sort of like, the original movie focused on integrating dragons into the society, right? So it was mostly about like, do we accept them or do we kill them? And it was this kid who was changing the ways people think, like changing their entire sort of being of being anti-dragon. So
I just remember it had the view that like a lot of leftist Star Trek has. And what I mean by that is you go to a new planet and necessarily you think those people are worth protecting because they're different from you. So different means good necessarily. And I thought the movie had a lot of that in there. And I don't like pushing that as a message to kids. The idea that because something is different, it's inherently good.
Yeah, the whole speech at the end, the preview is really what gave me the tackle. He's like, we should... fight for these people, or fight for the dragons. We should sacrifice for the dragons.
I think, Justin, you might be mixing the first and second movies a little bit.
I mean, I might be. I don't even remember what the second one's about. That's kind of why I'm fatigued here.
So the second one did have, like, these people who are going after the Vikings and their dragon, and they had to kill the mind control. Well, anyway, we don't need to get into it. Point is... this is an awesome series, and you're all wrong.
Well, let's see what you say about a new series that's developing here.
Second trailer.
Ralph Breaks the Internet, Wreck-It Ralph 2, is the sequel to Wreck-It Ralph. Wreck-It Ralph was about, of course, the movie about the guy who is the bad guy in a Super Mario-style game, Wreck-It Ralph. He's the guy who smashes things and then Fix-It Felix comes in and fixes it. And he gets out of his game and goes into video game world and is trying to not become the bad guy. The movie was wonderfully made in itself, but then the ending, of course, was communist, where it was just, you know your role. And if you have to be the bad guy, be the bad guy. That's your role in the greater society, blah, blah, blah. So then this movie comes around and Ralph goes to the internet with what's her name?
Sarah Silverman.
Sarah Silverman.
I don't know.
I just hear her as Sarah Silverman all the time. Hey, Christine, what is the name of Sarah Silverman's character in Wreck-It Ralph?
Candy Pop. Little candy girl. Candy hair. Candy face.
The candy girl.
Annoying kid. Small. Petite.
I thought you loved that movie. Okay, she doesn't know even though she loves the movie.
That's hilarious.
It's a whole other discussion. Anyway, he goes with her and... it's a lot of stuff making fun of the internet, and then it just completely becomes Disney synergy.
Oh, Vanellope Von Sweets.
Vanellope Von Sweets. That's the name of the character. Sweets. So Vanellope says, like, oh, I want to go to, like, a website that's crazy and awesome and blah, blah, blah. And there goes, there's only one result. And they basically sent her to Disneyland. And then it becomes a whole commentary on Disney. And about, oh, did no one believe, you know, you had problems until a big, strong man came to save them? Yeah. She is a princess. And then at the end, they even make fun of how dumb their own movie name is. Where, you know, they go, shouldn't it be Ralph Wrecks the Internet? Because he is Wreck-It Ralph after all. And they're like, yeah, but breaking the internet is like a thing. And to me, that felt like they're arguing for their name title with the audience. It didn't feel like a lantern hanging. It felt like we got to convince the audience that this is the right name, that we picked the right name. So I will probably see this because the animation is so great and I want to see the meta-ness of it. But I don't think it's going to be good. So this is like a hug tackle hybrid for me.
Hug?
I'm going to see it because of the good things about the art, but I also don't expect anything great out of this, especially thematically. Daniel?
I'm going to see it because there's Star Wars in it for like 4 seconds, and that's enough for me. But otherwise, I don't particularly care. I thought Wreck-It Ralph ruined itself with the ending and missed a lot of opportunities, so... It's too meta, too breaks the fourth wall, but so it's sort of a super reluctant hug, I guess.
Hug?
So this is Deadpool for children. I'm out. Tackle.
Tackle.
Because Deadpool only works for adults?
No, because it's all meta and fourth wall breaking and hanging lanterns everywhere. It's not going to rely on real comedy, it doesn't look like, from the preview. It's... I mean, Deadpool is okay, but like, if you take the, it's taking the meta elements from Deadpool, but at least in the preview, not showing a good execution. Like, oh look, we're going to make fun of Disney princesses. Oh look, we're like slightly interesting. We have a visual representation of the internet, but the internet's like 89.5% porn. So I don't think they're going to be representing the internet very well.
That's right.
Final trailer.
Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is an animated movie about the new Spider-Man, Miles Morales. Except in this one, he breaks the parallel dimension wall. So this is like a weird combination. I didn't even realize this is like a weird combination of the first two trailers. And goes into an alternate dimension where he meets Peter Parker, who's training him to become Spider-Man. He also meets Spider-Gwen, Gwen Stacy as a Spider-Woman at the end of this trailer. So it's going to be how many Spider-Men are in this movie. For me, and Daniel, I actually really want to hear what you have to say about the animation. So I'm going to sidestep that and let you talk about that. But for me, there was something that really stuck out, a line. And it's a line that's similar to a line that Joss Whedon added into Justice League. And in it, Peter Parker... tells Miles Morales, don't focus on saving the world, save one person. This is, of course, the same thing that Batman tells the Flash at a point in Justice League. He, you know, he's like, you know, if you don't know what to do, just focus on saving one person and getting that one person out. And when I heard this line, it made me realize that this is how they're going to be pushing altruism from now on. That all you have to do is give yourself for one other person, and that's how you become a hero, and that's how they're going to make altruism attainable. So there's just so much about this that's distasteful. It's doubling down on all of the things I don't like about modern superhero movies. It's also, you know, using Miles Morales, who, I don't know, maybe William can go into a bit of that history if he feels it's relevant. So for me, it's a tackle.
Tackle!
Daniel? I won't spoil it and say that I'm gonna watch this. This is a second reluctant hug from me. I'm gonna watch it because the animation style is very different from other animation styles. Although I have some critiques initially, which is that it looks like an animated Thomas Kinkade painting sometimes, which is a little overwhelming. But it looks sort of like it's a watercolor painting. I think that's interesting. I don't know how you sustain that visually for so long. What was another movie? Wasn't there another movie recently I said something about that? oh, the Trolls movie is essentially, it looks like every single thing in the movie is fuzzy, like literally has fur on it. I don't know how you sustain that. And they did a fine job of making it not overwhelming on the eyes for 90 minutes or however long it was. So the social justice stuff aside, I thought the dialogue was witty enough that that I could be in. And in fact, this is since the very first Spider-Man movie with Tobey Maguire, this is the first time I haven't hated watching Spider-Man in any moving pictures. So just for that reason alone, reluctant hug.
Hug?
William?
Yeah, so the 15 frames per second animation is a little weird. It looks interesting style-wise. It'd be cool to see what it looks like. My worry is that they're going to take the, you know, this character who's a pre-SJW Spider-Man and turn him into an SJW Spider-Man. So that's the concern here. So I'm going to give this a tentative hug.
Hug?
Wow. I'm shocked that you guys are both hugging this. I would have thought that this would be something that I would hug and you guys would tackle. That is shocking.
Shocking.
I mean, it's visually interesting, and there's multiple Spider-Mans. I mean, but the kid in me is like, can't be that bad. But then I remember how Marvel's been taking criticism lately and just going further left with it. So.
Well, to be fair, this is a Sony-produced movie. I mean, I'm sure Marvel had some input in it, but it's not like when Marvel led Spider-Man Homecoming. Yeah. So. All right. Let's round into our final segment here. It's time to talk about an interesting question I have for my two co-hosts here in Life on the Midside. So what I want to talk to you guys about this week, and I find it interesting because of the jobs the two of you have. What I want to talk about is the sort of idea of the difference between a job and work, or sort of like a job and like your career. And what I mean by that is for someone like me where, you know, what my true passion is in creativity, right? It's in writing, it's in discussing these movies, it's in, you know, the web series I made and hopefully further projects I have in the future. Just to survive, I'm going to have to, you know, take a job. And I'm doing that. I'm taking a job where it's gonna pay a good amount. And I'm going to be able to be comfortable and save money and build towards the future. But then most of my time is going to be towards that. And it's not going to be towards sort of like my work. So the thing I find interesting is, you guys are bad. You guys have both. You find both right in your jobs, I believe, is your jobs are also your passion and your work. So is that the ideal to move towards? Does our society make it difficult to actually have that nowadays? And is there something wrong? Is someone living a disintegrated life if they're not doing that? And if they don't have that overlap that you guys have, how do you go about living your life? Do you have to try and move towards that? Or is it okay to have sort of the disintegrated approach? It's a lot of stuff there.
So many questions.
Yeah. Well, that's the purpose of this segment.
Ask 1,000 questions and answer 2 of them? That's the purpose? Okay. So, I don't think it's disintegrated to take a job that you're not particularly interested in order to pay the bills. I think the integration comes in the fact that you're recognizing that you have to do something to sort of make your way in the world, to pay your bills, to provide housing, to provide food. Essentially, you have to trade your labor for sustenance in a certain sense, because no one is going to do that for you, and no one should do that for you. So I don't think it's disintegrated per se to do that. I think if you did it unthinkingly and never considered whether or not you could take a job that would be more fulfilling or more toward your values, then that would be disintegrated, and that would be bad. But I don't certainly think that's what you're doing, Justin, or what many of our listeners might be doing. I don't know. But I don't know. I've perhaps been fortunate that I've always been able to work in a field that is spiritually fulfilling for me. I am an activist at heart. And so doing work in the field of activism or ideas, you might say more broadly, the idea that I get to work to change culture is very fulfilling for me. And in fact, during my several years as an independent contractor, owning my own business, also got to do work like that almost all the time, which is rare. And the sort of one or two times I took gigs... took gigs where I didn't do that, to be very concrete, there was literally a guy, I tell this story way too often, who wanted me to set up a social media campaign for his cabinet company. And like I tried for maybe a day or a day and a half, and I finally just called him and said, I can't do this. There's nothing fulfilling to me about marketing your cabinets. I really just don't, they could be the best cabinets on the planet. I don't care about your cabinets. I can't do it. So... but I think everyone, including you, Justin, should work toward a world where they can be fulfilled by their job, be fulfilled by the work you're doing. And I don't think it's necessarily a world where you're doing something you expected to be doing. I'm sort of filibustering here, but one more point that people might want to check out would be like the documentary Jiro Dreams of Sushi, where making sushi was not something... This guy is considered the world's best sushi maker. I should put that out there. But making sushi is not something he ever expected to do in his life. He wanted to be an artist. He wanted to be a musician. But he found he was so good at it that the fulfilling part for him, the spiritual fuel for him, was being really good at something, even if the thing itself didn't particularly interest him for a long time. The rewarding part was the productivity part of it, the quality part of it. And I think almost anyone can do that in almost any job, at least for a certain amount of time. And filibuster.
Well, I have...
That didn't come off as a filibuster to me. That came off, I think that was very well stated.
Talk about job versus career, I have three words for you. False dichotomy, bro.
He said it! William said it.
So, especially in my work at Riot, and everyone who becomes a manager knows this, most of my work is not fun. It's mostly a job. And what I mean by that, it's a lot of details that I'm going through, a lot of notes that I'm taking, a lot of reading things, writing things, following up on tasks, those sort of things. It's all jobs, but I know that it integrates to my career. And what I mean by that is I enjoy managing people who are building complex things and protecting those things. That's something that I really, really enjoy doing. So for me, there's no dichotomy here. If I start to feel like I'm not doing something, you know, if something feels a little draining or if it feels tedious, you know, I try to connect back to that career of, hey, I'm here like that guy in the painting at the Walters, the Tool of Folly, you know, standing here with the sword, protecting the things that are important. And that is my career. So if I need to step back and make choices, there's some choices about your job that obviously you need to take care of yourself in order to fulfill this career. So if you're at the point in your career where you're, you know, digging ditches or, you know, working for me making sandwiches, that's fine. Like Daniel was saying, apply your excellence there, get your skills going there. Even in my store, I grow people into supervisors and managers, teaching them those skills, because I know that if they, you know, hey, if they decide to stay in food service, it's a rewarding career path. Just look at my business partner. But if you're just in college and this is just a temporary thing, it's still your career. Your career isn't food service here. It's learning how to be a good employee, learning how to be a good supervisor, how to be a good manager, how to give good feedback, all those things that feed into the skills that integrate into a career. And I always tell people when I'm having one-on-ones with them, especially with folks at the store, like, hey, this is connecting. Here's how this connects to your career, right? Like, this is why we look for these things and why we reward these things and why I expect these things, you know, because it's not just making sandwiches. It's learning these skills so that you can move forward in your career, whatever your career is going to be. And it's okay if you don't know what that career is. I mean, that's a place that people are in, but you can still build those things, you know, like build that house, and you start at the foundation and you can kind of build it up. So I would say there's a lot of things. If you do know what your passion is and you do know what you want to do, then you have to be conscious of whether you're making decisions. You have to take time out of your week, every week or every month, to think about those meta decisions about your career. And what I mean by that is, where do you want to see yourself in 6 months, in a year? What's the next step in the job you're in? Or is it time to look at another job? Are you looking for opportunities week to week, month to month, to increase your responsibility, increase your skills, find new opportunities? And that's how you keep that, you know, it's not job versus career. It is job integrating with career.
Yeah, there you go.
I don't think if you asked me when I was in elementary school, I would have told you I wanted to be an astronaut. If you had asked me in junior high, I would have told you I wanted to be Geordi LaForge on the Star Trek, on the Starship Enterprise. If you had asked me in high school, I would have told you I wanted to go to Silicon Valley and work for Micron or Intel or Apple. And at no point would I have said, oh, I want to work at the NSA and learn to be a hacker. Oh, I want to work at SpaceX and protect rockets as they launch into space. Or, oh, I want to work on one of the world's most popular games and entertain millions of people and protect our game from hackers. None of those things were things I consciously chose at the beginning, but at each opportunity I was integrating that with, hey, does this fit with the things that I love? Does this fit with the things that give me spiritual fuel?
Totally. Justin, what is your thinking on this?
It's interesting.
Lately?
Are you talking to me? Justin, right? Oh, I didn't hear you say that because I started talking. I was just going to say it's interesting what William's saying about not even if you don't necessarily know what the macro is, build yourself on a macro level, even if you're only stuck in the micro level currently. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to integrate it even if you're not sure. If you're not sure, as long as you're starting, as long as you're looking at the lower levels and trying to integrate them, you'll figure it out. It's just like building any other like complex idea, right? You don't start with the final solution, right? The big overall arching concept. You have to kind of build the building blocks and learn as you go. And you might find like the sushi guy that, you know, maybe you didn't want to be, you know, maybe I did want to be an astronaut, you know, like, or it's not that I didn't want to, but maybe that's not really what I would really find a passion is. You know, like I absolutely hate long distance running, and that would certainly be part of being an astronaut, right? Is being able to handle long distance endurance things. And you know, I built the building blocks of me, I developed my passions and my interests and my talents in computers, and you know, that's where things led me.
Yeah, and there's a distinction, I think, between pleasure and satisfaction. I don't even want to say happiness and satisfaction because it's sort of like it's not a good definition of happiness, I guess. So people tend to not like their job because they don't get pleasure out of their job. But as William is talking about, a lot of what you might do on a daily basis isn't pleasurable. Like, it's not like drinking a beer or eating cake or things that...
something Justin, you know, actually does.
I'm trying to think of stuff Justin does. Buying a pop.
I mean, what you're referring to is, like, people would commonly say, like, lifting weights at the gym is not pleasurable.
It doesn't... Right. Right. It's not a direct... It's pleasure stimulator. But the point is, in the thing you're getting out of it in the long run is satisfaction. the satisfaction come from a job well done, or the sort of an overarching arc to your career, or even on a smaller level, an overarching arc to a specific project, or, you know, seeing something happen in reality, or seeing, you know, people better off because of it, whatever your values are, whatever the thing is that you're pursuing in life, the satisfaction comes in the long run and not in the individual moments, which are not particularly pleasurable for most people in most jobs.
Yeah, for me, one thing that this kind of reminds me of, when I decided to leave the NSA, which was a big deal for me, I knew I wanted to do it because I knew I couldn't stay. There's a aspect of working for the government that people just stop growing at a certain point. It's really hard to keep that entrepreneurial, that growth mindset in a bureaucracy. And I knew I wanted to go, but like, where do you go? You know, I'm with the best hackers in the world. Where do you go from here? You know, I didn't know, you know, but that mindset that I had at the time, which I still have today, is like, well, I'll figure it out, right? That we'll, you know, we'll make some choices, we'll try some things, we'll figure it out. And I think that's the approach. If you're not sure what your career, quote unquote, is, I would say that's perfectly normal, and that's part of the fun. It's not that you have a map. I mean, some people do. Some people really want to be a writer or an artist or a musician, and they have a map, and they can kind of figure it out. There's a way to get big in the music industry. There's a way to get big in, as an author. But a lot of authors and musicians don't follow that map. So it's perfectly okay for you to not follow that map. And it's perfectly okay to decide to, you know, write your own map, to figure out your own way to find the things that integrate into a career. And the career is the end, right? It's the entirely integrated path. You know, my first not farm job was working at Radio Shack, right? But that integrates today with me working at Riot Games. My first job in college was in the cafeteria in the dorm, and now I own a restaurant. So these things, you can integrate these things and these experiences into things that become fulfilling for you. You have to build it, though. You build your career. It's not something that you go find in the world and you pick it like an apple. It's something that you build yourself.
Yeah, I think what stands out about what you're saying, and I think this is a good place to sum it up and to end this episode, is the thing you're talking about with the map. There's such an emphasis placed on, oh, know where you're going to be in 5 years, know where you're going to be in 10 years. And it sounds like that's less important. And what's more important is finding out how to maximize what you're immediately doing and then make the best immediate choice, and that eventually that will pay off in the long run, as long as you're continuing to make the best choice that is immediately in front of you, rather than focus on making a choice now because it will hopefully lead to where you want to be, some concrete spot.
Yeah, I guess
later
I would say the way I would characterize it is, it's okay, like, it's essential that you think about how this decision will affect you in 1 year and 5 year as you make making decisions, and think about that weekly or monthly or whatever makes sense for you, about how the decisions with your job related decisions are integrating into your career. But it's okay at the same time for those to be fuzzy or for you to change your mind, right? Like if your goal is to become a mid-side host, you know, you're not going to get that in a year or 6 months or 5 years without thinking about, well, what's the things that, you know, what are the decisions I'm making now that help me get there, right? That what are the skills I need to get there? And then what things can I find out about myself or reality to figure out if this is right for me? So it's okay for those things to be fuzzy in the 1 and 5 year areas. So have a direction you're walking, but not a particular like coordinate point, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense, especially when you say mid-side host, because for me, I would have never thought I would have a podcast for 6 years that has this many supporters and that many people listen to. So I get what you're saying. Any final thoughts, Daniel, or are we ready to say what we learned this trip?
I am so ready to say what I learned this trip.
All right, go ahead. And don't say that I have terrible taste in movies because of The Incredibles.
Close. I was going to say that I've learned that Justin's pleasure centers are just little tiny nuked nubs at this point. And he needs to go to Bali and do some yoga for about a month and be disconnected from the world, and then he'll come back with a fresh set of pleasure centers ready to enjoy media again.
That actually may be more true than you say, than you realize, because I do actually say I want to just disconnect from everything for a while because I'm just sick of everything.
Good help. So. Only being a little bit sarcastic.
Yeah, I need money to go to Bali. So let's kickstart. Let's crowdfund Justin Goes to Bali.
Yeah, we only have enough money for Bollywood.
William?
So.
Probably not. Well, I learned this trip that if you like Wreck-It Ralph, you're a secret communist.
Mm-hmm. No, I wouldn't say that. I would say the movie is secret communist, but let's not conflate those
no,
two.
No, I'm applying the group to all individuals. I'm applying that fallacy.
Has anyone noticed...
Very good. Do we have a name for that fallacy?
Hmm. Oh, I'm sure there is
the
a name
Saul
for that fallacy.
The Alinsky fallacy?
It's a frozen abstraction, isn't it? Because you're taking, like, you're saying, oh, this abstract thing is a thing, and then you apply it to all the particulars, no matter what the context.
Oh, a frozen abstraction isn't when you let it go?
Let it go.
Hilarious. Has anyone noticed that the DreamWorks logo looks a little bit like the hammer and sickle?
Ooh.
Just wondering. Okay, Justin, what did you learn this week?
Apparently DreamWorks is communist?
Commies everywhere.
We need...
Commies everywhere, commies everywhere. That was a reference to an obscure pop song.
So if you learned this week anything about communism or Wreck-It Ralph or feminism or suicide, why don't you tell us over at The Midside? All the social medias at The Midside, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, Vero, and probably some others that Justin is secretly hiding under his bed. You can tell your friends about the show. We appreciate that. Always telling a friend is a good idea. You can also go to themidside.com/store and pick up a False Dichotomy Bro shirt. Wear your False Dichotomy statement loud and proud. That's right, loud and proud. Well, maybe someday we'll get our own parade. Probably not, though. You can also go to themidside.com/podcast and listen to all the episodes of the show going back for basically ever. Going to iTunes or Google Play will allow you to subscribe to the show, getting it delivered to you on the device of your choice the moment it is published. You can also give us 5 stars. A 5-star rating helps us move up in the search results, hopefully someday surpassing Welcome to Night Vale. If only. If you can't do that, you can also go to patreon.com/themidside, where you can subscribe, i.e. give us a few bucks every time we produce a piece of content. Helps us keep the lights on, helps us keep the hosting on, really, if I want to be really specific about it. And we release Patreon-exclusive content there, so stuff you're not going to get just by listening to the main show, although the main show will always remain free. Recently released a review of Solo, right, Justin? What else is up there on Patreon-exclusive only content?
Oh, we have the first ever episode from our Lost season is up there, and there will be more of those episodes coming.
Right. And we have our exclusive Discord channel for Patreon members only.
Wow.
Where we discuss other secret topics.
The most secretest topics are on the Patreon Discord, so check that out. Or check out the regular Discord where we have not-so-secret topics. Tell a friend about the show. That really helps. Thanks to Liberty.me for syndicating us. I think they still do that. We love our libertarian friends. And until next time, au revoir.
This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin M. Wisniewski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day. the internet's like 89.5% porn. So I don't think they're going to be representing the internet very well.